you. All you goddamn Ron Paul supporters, you Gary Johnson voting douchebags, kiss my ass. Come on over. I'll fucking kill you and I'll enjoy doing it. You goddamn motherfuckers. You think another 4 years of Obama is going to be so much better than 4 years of Romney? You're too fucking stupid to live here. Go to hell, libertarians. Kiss my ass, you fucking bastards. You think you voted for something. You didn't vote for shit. You helped Obama win, you fucking assholes. And there is a very large segment of this society that will never forgive you for that. So fuck off!
When all you have is a search engine, everything looks like a database.
Man, I have like a cypherpunk hard on right now.
Privacy is nothing to be granted. Privacy is something you take yourself.
They've got the Mossad, the CIA, and Hillary Clinton behind them.
We're now beyond what the Stasi could even dream of.
Reality Exploit Roundtable.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Reality Exploit Roundtable, episode number 13. This is Hero White, your moderator. Today, we have several of our regular panelists with us. Welcome back to the show, Voodoo.
Hey,
Smuggler.
Guten Tag.
Wise Guy, you there?
What's up?
And Plato, our man in Washington.
Good morning.
All right. Well, we have several interesting topics, and all of you should know that we're not going to be covering election, U.S. election, so that should be a sigh of relief to most of you. Our first topic today, we're going to start off with Wise Guy. Border Nazis scan debit cards in the United States. From the Forbes blog by John Matonis, he writes, travelers leaving or entering the United States have long had to declare aggregated cash and other monetary instruments exceeding $10,000. Now, under a proposal amendment to the Bank Secrecy Act, FinCEN, Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, will also require travelers to declare the value of prepaid cards that they are carrying, known now as, quote, tangible prepaid access devices. Expected to be finalized by the end of this year, the cross-border reporting notification stemmed from a broader October 2011 definition of payment methods and form factors that replaced the term stored value with the term prepaid access in an effort to more accurately describe the process of accessing funds held by a payment provider. Enforceability falls to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement and U.S. Customs and Border Protection, both with the Department of Homeland Security, which is already developing advanced handheld card readers that can ascertain whether a traveler is carrying a credit card, debit card, or prepaid card. This differentiation is important because only prepaid card balances will need to be added to declaration report forms. Wise Guy. Assuming the system was in place and all cards were being scanned, how easy is it to get around these border Nazis and avoid reporting your $10,000 of either the so-called store value rules?
Well, it seems to me that this is just going to push more business people into carrying things like the Bitcoin brain wallet codes with them and then meeting up with an exchanger on the other side of the border and getting cash for codes, you know, that way. I wonder if they're going to scan all the cards to just make sure that those that look like a Visa credit card is not just a fake plastic vanity card, yet inside the strip an actual tangible prepaid access device, as they call it, and it's actually there. Now, carrying one way to get around, if you're not going to go to Bitcoin, to get around these kinds of systems is to carry a Carter database made from scans of your plastic cards and stored on your mobile. That can either be complemented by a secure smart card which holds data from multiple plastic cards and can assume the identity of any one of them in a few seconds. For an example, I think it's called Card 2.0 from Dynamics, Inc. Or using a low-cost mag stripe writers which complement miniature low-cost readers like those from Square. Many people have got those connected to their iPhones and Android phones so that they can accept credit cards. You see them all the time at small fairs. And enabling then any plain magstripe card to sequentially assume new identities. These are all things that are familiar to people in the Carter communities, and I think that since the products are available widely and legally, we're going to start seeing some people utilizing them.
So you're saying when they have these, I've seen these portable card readers for taking credit card payments, but you're saying that they have writers that look similar, and are the cards that are available with the magnetic stripes, are they also read-write, or are they write once only?
Well, all magnetic cards can be rewritten, and cards are cheap. People use them for access control. You can buy cards with no information on them and use a writer with them. Now, currently, the writers are pretty expensive. They're certainly not like the readers. You can go to, for example, I think Best Buy and buy a square reader for $10. They're just off-the-shelf items, no ID required. And any of those will plug right into your mobile phone, like an Android or an iPhone. And there's actually software available now, hacker software, which will read that information. Now, unfortunately, the writers are not so cheap. They're probably in the 150 plus range. But there's no reason that someone couldn't come out with a writer that connects to the USB port. You need something with some kind of protocol control for a writer, unlike what you do for a reader. And I can see if the need's there, some people will come out with them.
Yeah, well, someone's moving cards around with them. $150 for a writer is not really that. That's not too big of a price. I mean, considering that you could wipe your cards and then cross a border and then rewrite the information to them.
Right, and it would be no problem really to design a device that was a reader and a writer and was inexpensive and connected to your mobile phone's USB port.
Yeah, of course, if they were looking at the card, they could see card numbers and stuff like that if you were using like an existing card that you needed for showing physical presentation to somebody that for a payment. But if you're just talking about a card that would work in any ATM machine, that would be something else.
Well, actually, you could bring a legitimate card through that acts as sort of a foil so that when they scan it, everything is cool. And as soon as you get across the border, you can repurpose that card, which wasn't that important to you anyway. And when you're done with your transactions, you can move the data back onto that card and it's back to what its original values were. So any card is rewritable. So it's not a problem.
You know, one thing I found interesting in here, Smuggler, did you notice in this article where it said that Homeland Security was developing advanced handheld card readers that can ascertain whether a traveler is carrying a credit card, debit card, and prepaid card? What is that? Because this is something different than they're talking about ascertaining what kind of card that they're carrying. This is something different than necessarily a machine that just, you know, reads the balance or you know, card information.
Actually, it's not that difference because to find out the balance or the type of the card, the only thing you need is a credit card processor. And if they open the API for you, you can find out what the available balance on the card is and what type of the card that is. So essentially what they will do is scan the card and do an online check on the balance by talking to a payment processing provider who talks with a bank. So the fun thing here is that essentially the DHS will have probably the biggest carders database in the future.
Hack, 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 hack.
Well, yeah. Well, hold on. More than the biggest carder database, because a lot of the carder databases don't contain balance information. I mean, if these guys are running these through, they're going to like trigger the balance. And I guess back to that was what my question was that the title of this article talks about them scanning prepaid cards. But this appears to be that, something of the effect that where they're going to be scanning, possibly all credit cards, debit cards, and prepaid cards, and then comparing the ones that come up with prepaid, with your customs declaration.
Yeah, it's awesome. And the thing is, I personally think there's only one reason to do that, and that is get as many cards as you can so the budget deficit can be battled with the knowledge of cards. Because, you know, it really makes no sense. Because people who want to smuggle money, they will smuggle money, as Wise Guy already said. It's probably not as easy as he said, but easy enough for any smart person to do it. And the thing is, most of those prepaid cards, you cannot actually use them offshore. You cannot take a US prepaid card and go to Europe and pay with that, because most of those prepaid cards and gift cards and whatever are bound to jurisdiction. I mean, go to a 7-Eleven, buy a $100 Visa card, try to use it in Germany. It won't work.
Okay,
well,
so
that's
you're...
I was going to say, that's not really true. Yes, it's true that the retail cards that you buy, for instance, if you walk into a shopping mall, that's Simon Malls, for example, that operates the largest range of shopping malls in the United States, and you walk up as just a regular citizen, consumer, you can, and the cards you buy, you're right, they're basically locked to U.S. Merchants. But if you present yourself as a small business, they'll sell you cards that will operate with any merchant in the world, online or offline.
Are there particular limits on those cards?
Yeah, I think that Simon's is at $500, but there are other companies in the United States who will sell you cards that go up to the $2,000 limit. That's pretty much been set by law.
Right. Okay. So you get if you can, you stash 10 of those cards maxed out, you're crossing the border with 20K. Real quick, back on Smuggler, you were saying that essentially you were saying that this whole prepaid card thing is a pretext for actual scanning of the credit card and debit card, and they're using this so-called anonymous prepaid cards as the pretext for doing the scanning. And you mentioned the deficit thing. How would that be done? What would be the conspiracy theory there? How would that work?
Oh, I was just joking, because if I'm the DHS and I have the biggest database of credit cards and their balances or authorized volumes, then I could probably go and transfer that money to the White House so that the deficit is reduced. But I was joking. I'm not really saying they will do that.
Yeah, okay. Well, there are other security implications here, and that is there's these international banking, I forget what the name of the banking law is right now, where foreign banks are required to turn over the information of U.S. citizens with certain amounts of activity and balances and the like, is that if they actually wind up scanning every credit card, let's assume that they scan every one of these cards to see what they are, and then they get the information of those cards, then you could quite possibly, any person who's leaving the United States or traveling in or out of the United States who has foreign banks with cards in their name or bank accounts in other people's names with those ATM cards in their pocket, they're going to be blowing their cover. So there
exactly.
could be, this could be much more sinister as an information gathering thing for them to find out about this information. And also, if they started just seizing these things, which like they're doing with people's electronic devices and the like, you can really screw up capital flow for a lot of people. So let's go ahead and have anything else to say on this, Plato?
I just wonder whether we would ever see a payment processor, say some small company that's trying to do their own like Bitcoin debit card. I wonder if we could ever see them issuing privacy controls on their servers. So as a user, you could call them and request, hey, could you just blank out my account information for the next 3 days? When you know you're going to travel.
Yeah,
and then
absolutely.
They report, oh, hey, you have $1.
That's actually a very legitimate security feature that credit card companies and the like could put into practice right now. If you're doing international travel, you're hitting all kinds of airports and doing different things, and you have a couple of a Visa card, some type of these cards, you could wait until you actually get to your destination and you're safe, just in case there was some type of a theft or whatever. That's a
Here's
great
something
suggestion.
Else. You could also just have a worldwide network of people who own card readers, and for a nominal fee, you pull out your USB key, download the file that contains like the correct content of all the mag strips. They read it off your flash drive, put them all back on the cards once you land.
Yeah, card writer service, exactly. Voodoo, do you have something to say?
Yeah, they have another charge. So even if you went through with a bunch of cards that each set a dollar, they can still charge you with structuring on that. They can say, well, you're trying to evade this law, so therefore you are guilty of structuring, and structuring can be a higher penalty even than the money laundering charge in the first place.
Yeah, there is one thing you could also do is if the depending on how the magnetic stripes are set up and the cards are, you could take your Walmart frequent shopper card and have that actually carry that with you, and then a writer when you're on the other side of the border actually have a writer write on the correct ATM information on the card, so then you're not even carrying a bank card or a blank one.
Yeah, or hotel room keys.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Well, here, I was going to say, regarding the security feature you were talking about by locking your account, that's already available. A number of the different prepaid card companies will allow you to call in, and when you identify them yourself, they will lock it so that you actually have to call in and provide that security information to unlock your card.
They might still well provide account information to a government, though.
Not unless they call in with that number.
The thing that I find a little bit freaky here is the actual term that they use, and that is this prepaid access token. I mean, what is a prepaid access token? It's not just a credit card. In my opinion, that might actually apply to two-factor authentication systems to online banking, doesn't it?
Yeah, actually, let's what were they calling it before? They were calling it a store. Okay, here's the terms. They had stored value is what some of these regulations and legal terms were. And this the new word, and you're right, Smuggler, I thought this was very interesting. And it's something we need to think about, like you brought up. What does this actually mean? The quote, tangible prepaid access devices.
So that would include phones too, prepaid phones.
YubiKeys?
Well, there was a section at the bottom of the article where someone brought up something about access codes and passwords and the like, and they said something to the effect of, no, these would not be covered. We're looking at actual tangible physical access devices. So the card itself is being considered an actual device, and it was also interesting that their reason for doing that is because if they actually started to move into the area of passwords, they're not necessarily sure what power they have and where that would go and everything. It's so funny that they're basing these things based upon what their capabilities are, not necessarily about, you know, what is, you know, a crime or not.
Oh, so wait a second. So if it has to be a tangible device, if you just have a security access card like they would use at a company with a mag stripe, and some of them have embedded white, you know, RFIs and things like that, and you have a database that's stored on your mobile, that database is not a tangible access device. It's the card. So that means that you're not bringing any tangible access device across the border, are you?
Okay. Next topic with Voodoo. go ahead and roll this warrant clip.
Excuse me, what's going on here?
Hi. How are you? How are you?
I'm not well. There are strangers in my house.
Oh, no, we're not strangers.
Well, what are you doing here?
We have an administrative inspection warrant issued by the District Division 8th Circuit Court in Keene yesterday. I'll give you a copy. We left one for this gentleman, but he didn't accept it.
What's this regarding?
It's along with the fire captain's complaint. We had received a complaint.
By whom?
Mr. Passells is a housing inspector. They filed a complaint to the fire department. My name is Captain Lafreniere. If this helps you, I'll give you a card. You don't have to take it if you don't want. And we're answering the complaint, seeing if we have evidence that there's more than a single or two-family house here going on. That's the complaint.
Okay, it appears that the fire department and the local government in Keene, this is New Hampshire, is there was a couple of clips that are we linked to inside of the site, but they're doing these home inspections where they actually go and they get a warrant to come into the house to do an inspection based upon complaints that they have that more than a couple of people were living there. One of the clips, I think they said that if the people in a particular home in this county are not related to each other, then, and the house is considered a single family home, then no more than four people are allowed to be in it. Now they're walking around the house and they're mainly looking for, fire detectors, and, they're just knocking on doors going from room to room. Voodoo, how is this possible that in the United States, you know, we all grew up with, this supposed to be a free country, that warrants can be issued for things that are not crimes? They just come around, there's no probable cause or anything, go get a warrant, and they just come into your home and you know, go from room to room. You know, people complain about federal tyranny all the time, but if you look at so many of these reports of police abuse, so much of it is local police and things like this.
Yeah, in the case of the Keene Activity Center, both of these are an eerie coincidence. You've got the Keene Activity Center and the Adam versus the Man Studios. The Adam versus the Man Studios are actually somewhere around DC, I think in Arlington, Virginia. So in the case of the Keene Activity Center, this is actually a duplex that's owned by Ian Freeman, the host of Free Talk Live, and it's a temporary autonomous zone for activists, liberty activists there in Keene, New Hampshire. They drew attention to themselves, and obviously Ian Freeman is a big target there, and so this warrant was signed by this Judge Burke, and there was a lawsuit that came of this. One of the guys that they woke up in this raid actually sued the city of Keene for a violation of civil rights. And through the entire hearing, the city right away motioned for dismissal. Through this dismissal hearing, there was no recognition whatsoever that this was obviously some sort of a vendetta warrant that this Burke had signed. That the Freeman and this Judge Burke have an ongoing war going. So this was just the brickbat of the state being called on that. So it's very eerie coincidence then that this exact same excuse is used down at the Adam versus the Man Studios, where Derek J. Freeman, who was a co-host on Free Talk Live, just happens to be working for Adam Kokesh down in the Adam versus the Man Studios now. So you know, it almost has a vendetta feel to it, like somebody's calling these in. But more likely, they drew attention to themselves, and I guess that would be the lesson to learn from this, is that if you are going to set up a TAS, if you're going to set up a temporary autonomous zone, if you draw attention to it, you are going to draw state attention there. So you need to think of tradecraft of the outside of your TAS as well. Don't park a whole bunch of cars in the driveway. That there's a good tip off right there that something's going on. Don't have people coming in and out of the front door 24/7. These are all tip offs, you know, especially in residential areas. You need to be thinking of the outside appearance of your TAS as part of your security.
Yeah, another thing I can say is I saw something. I didn't know who these homes belong to. This is good information that you're bringing up. I did notice that when they went into one room where there were several bunk beds, you heard the fire official say something like, "Oh, this is the one we saw on the video on the website." So it does appear that these guys were somehow advertising the actual address and location of the house itself, and that they were, you know, renting out rooms or something like that.
I think I think another thing that should be brought up here is that if you're running a TAS, you know, don't be a dick and start a fight with everybody about everything.
Yeah, that's certainly a big part of it. And it, to be fair, neither one of these places are running as a secure TAS. They're not thinking about security, so you know, it's not they're they just the reason I thought these were good stories is I think they're very illustrative that if you do draw attention to yourself in this way, and let's face it, we're going to have to band together in more of these kinds of things as TAS get going. If you draw attention to yourself in this way, you are going to receive state aggression.
Well, yeah, that's the thing with this is that what's a little shocking to me, and I understand that it would be normal for a fire inspector to go into some place which is operating as a licensed club or something like that to make sure that there were exit signs and, you know, these things that they do for fire hazards and the like. But to think that you own a home, right? And, I mean, you could be living in your home and these guys come up with a warrant to inspect your home and you could be sitting there having sex with your wife and they have a right to come in to your room and inspect it with you there. There's no, these guys can just walk into your house and it's not even about a crime being committed. There's no, you know, probable cause and all this type of a thing. When they have a warrant, it's the same thing as if they had a warrant for a murder that took place the day before or something like that. These guys are coming into your home and they're going to be looking around and hunting. I just find it to be, appalling, especially when you consider like the castle doctrine. And then you go back a couple hundred years in the United States and think about, is this the type of liberty that they're talking about where someone could just come into your home and, you know, walk around and you could be there with no clothes on? And they're just walking around, you know. I mean, it's hard to fathom from a liberty standpoint.
Well, the really interesting thing is, first you get a warrant for some home inspection, then the home inspector comes around, sees your bongs, and then you get another warrant for drug use.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was actually where I was going to go next with this. Is that it's a pretext if they can just literally walk in at any time. And you can't say, come back a little bit later, you know. Or they come in there and it's over. Anyone else have something to say on this, Plato wise guy?
Nope.
Okay, we'll move on to the next topic. Okay, well, today we have two interesting camera-related items. And the first one we're going to start off with is, and this is going to be for Smuggler, Creepy Cameraman Pushes Limits of Public Surveillance. Let's go ahead and roll that clip.
Sorry, I just asked. You're taking a photo of what? Because I'm sitting right there, and you didn't get my permission to take my
picture. A video
of me? Not okay. You didn't ask me if you could take a picture of me, sir. You didn't ask if you take a picture of me, and you still have me on camera.
Yeah.
And that's not okay with me.
Okay.
That's an invasion of my privacy and my time.
Aren't there cameras in there?
No, sir. But you're taking a picture of me.
What's that? What's that one?
No. I need to ask you to take that off. Me off of your camera, please. Thank you. Why are you taking a picture of me, sir? I need you guys to call 911, please. Sir, this is America, and I have a choice that you do not take a picture of me.
Wow. So anyway, we have links inside of the show notes, and I recommend everyone check out these video clips. It's pretty fascinating. So this guy's going around with a cell phone camera or something like that, and he's just walking up to people that are sitting in outside drinking coffee at a restaurant or coming out of stores and the like, and he's a real dick for what he's doing in the videos. This is like real and not any type of setup type thing. He's filming these people, and they're just getting very upset and sometimes aggressive with them. So I found it pretty fascinating because everyone has these cameras on them and recording devices, cameras and microphones on them all over the place now increasingly. But when there's a human person standing there with the camera pointing it at them, they start to really become aware that they're being recorded and they freak out. So for me, I found a couple of lessons from this. It seems like people do care about their privacy when they're truly aware of an individual sitting there behind the camera or behind the microphone. But everyone sees them, the current recording devices as being so depersonalized that they don't necessarily feel it. And the other lesson I have is, if you're going to be big brother on everyone, make sure that you don't have a human face associated with it. Have it as mechanized and depersonalized as you can, and then the people really don't care. Hey, Smuggler, do you like this creepy cameraman?
Oh, I love him. I mean, I'm really thinking about doing the same thing just for public education, because it really challenges people to think about surveillance, camera surveillance, CCTV, and all that shit. If you are scared about a person running around with a camera taking pictures of you, which is something I personally don't like, and I usually freak out if someone takes a picture of me. But if you don't like that, so please don't like the automatic CCTV cameras either.
Yeah, I really dug this clip, right? The audio that we just played, because you know, far from getting the whole point that, hey, there's no difference between me standing here with a camera and that camera that he was pointing out at on the ceiling. The lady had no problem with the camera on the ceiling, but just because there was a human holding that camera, she was freaking out. And then the other thing I liked is that she there's a lot of people in there that'll say, well, this is America. I have a right not to be filmed. And turns out in America, you have zero right not to be filmed.
The interesting thing about the cameraman versus the cameras on the ceiling is I think people think that the cameras on the ceiling, they have some authority to sit there and are there for their security, while this guy running around with a camera is just a douchebag.
Good point.
Yeah, what is the term that they bring up whenever they talk about recording? Government recording information, they talk about there being proper safeguards to safeguards from abuse are in place, or I forget the particular soundbite that they always say.
Yeah, right. Just like how that New Jersey cop got her profile accessed by like 500 other cops because they thought she was hot.
Well, also, too, you know, I would lean a little bit toward the depersonalization thing also, because they may assume that for a lot of devices that are up there, but if you actually had police officers walking around with video cameras up and down the street, and then, you know, just literally just walking up to people and doing the same thing as a police officer, I think you would get, you may not get the people getting as abusive and violent as they did in some of these clips, but I think that inside the people would be just as freaked out and terrified. I know that I also, whenever I've seen these police cars that have cameras mounted on them, you know, driving through a city or something like that in videos, I also think I see that also as something a little bit different, even than when you have a street corner that has, you know, a camera up there, even recording people coming by.
So what can people do about this?
Play video games, don't go outside.
How about people wearing full face sunglasses, face mask sunglasses? I see Asians all the time in my neighborhoods doing this. And although there are community ordinances that prohibit masks, I've never seen any enforcement against full faceplate sunglasses.
Yeah, I mean, wearing a mask is probably the new fashion trend in the future. I mean, look at the privacy extremists running around at conferences. I mean, that's the way you have to go. Not just against CCTV, but against all those douchebags with their video phones that are streamed directly to Facebook.
So, yeah, so everyone's going to be walking around like Vendetta.
Nice.
Smuggler, I figured out the most creepy thing you could do to get this point across. Go to an adult bookstore where there's a camera in the corner videoing people as they're browsing the adult books, but then stand there and video them as holding the camera in your hand. That'd be ultra creepy.
The risk is that the people attending that bookstore might start to strip while you're holding the camera at them.
Oh my god!
Well, whatever draws the attention from your face.
Well, I mean, to be fair, the owners of the shop will probably kick you out pretty quick, but there's nothing stopping you from standing on the street and filming people walking in and out.
Oh, geez, real quick, let's move on to the next camera item. The police allowed to install cameras on private property without warrant. Ars Technica writes, a federal judge has ruled in the U.S., of course, that police officers in Wisconsin did not violate Fourth Amendment when they secretly installed cameras on private property without judicial approval. The officers installed the cameras in an open field where they suspected the defendants, Mendoza and Magana, were growing weed. The police eventually obtained a search warrant, but not until after some potentially incriminating images were captured by the cameras. The defendants have asked the judge to suppress all images collected prior to the issuance of the search warrant. But in a Monday decision first reported by CNET, Judge Griesbach rejected the request. Instead, he approved the ruling of a magistrate judge that the Fourth Amendment only protected the home and land directly outside of it, known as curtilage, not open fields far from any residents. The Fourth Amendment protects, quote, the right of the people to be secure in persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. The court ruled that under applicable Supreme Court precedents, open fields, as distinguished from curtilage, are not effects within meaning of the Fourth Amendment. Smuggler, one funny part of this claim by Mendoza and Magana was that they did not even own the property they were growing weed on. If others are growing weed in open fields, what tech is there that can be used to detect cameras or other surveillance electronic devices in any given area?
Well, actually, it's pretty hard to do to find surveillance technology. It's hard to find bugs. It's hard to find cameras. I mean, there are those things out there that help you to find lenses. There are special lighting systems that use a reflection of the lens so you can see it. But that is kind of hard, especially if you have a wide open field. The camera can be quite far away. Also, you could try to find the transmission, which is equally hard and almost unable to do, especially if they're using uplinks through Wi-Fi or 3G or something like that. So actually finding a surveillance device in the plain open field is nearly impossible. The thing that you should do instead is set up the first anti-surveillance rule at all, and that is limit the area of surveillance. Make sure there are obstructions that make it hard to surveil the area from a long distance, from a far distance. Also make sure that there's actually no incriminating data, like your face on any recording. So wear a mask if you water your plants. And lastly, what you really have to do in such a situation is run a counter-surveillance operation, which actually means that before you are going to grow weed on that plot or do anything else, is set up your own surveillance. So whenever your enemies come in and set up their surveillance, you can actually film them, record them, and detect them doing that. So essentially put up your own cameras pointing away from the area of the crime, of course, so you're not incriminating yourself. And check if people come by and put interesting things into the trees or something like that. And the good thing with counter-surveillance and finding out if things are planted is you can later on go and pick up the devices and then increase your own stock of counter-surveillance technology.
Another option is a tactic that I saw online once. It was a set of photos of like 30 subway cars that were buried underground and used for a grow op. I mean, obviously, that's a lot more startup costs and money to spend than just putting up some cameras and keeping it safe above ground. But, you know, it's kind of hard to get cameras underground for now, at least.
And humans are really crappy, depending on how open the terrain is. Humans are really crappy at moving through like brush. So if you've got brushy areas and then a game trail going through that, you can just put a camera right on that game trail, and I guarantee you that's the route the human's going to take in and out of there.
What humans are you talking about?
Yeah, most likely.
All they got to do is fly over with a thermal imaging drone, like Texas just bought.
Yeah, and I think that might be the more likely attack vector. The odds of, I mean, unless they've got good intel that you are actually using a field as a grow op, the more likely attack vector would be the helicopter observation.
Yeah, but well, there's different. Go ahead, Smuggler.
Well, there are two different kinds of operation in question here. There's number one, the operation of finding such a place, and number two is finding the people operating the place. You cannot have a helicopter and even a drone hovering over some small patch of weed waiting for the gardeners to check on their plants. That is why you're setting up cameras locally and on the ground, and specifically on entry and exit routes. So those are two kinds of operation in question here. You will probably have a thermal imaging system that scoops the area for potential targets, and then local imaging to create evidence for a case.
Well, you know, there are people that do plane spotting, just like train spotting, and recent FAA rules that have been enacted require that all domestic drones that are non-military have to have transponders, which means that it's very easy to get a receiver that will pick up the transponder codes, compare them against the database, and you'll know whether you're under observation, either by helicopters from the police or, you know, various federal agencies. Military is exempt, but you'll be able to figure all of this out because the skies over most areas are being swept by radar constantly for air traffic control, and those transponders must respond.
Problem is with that, wise guys, I've never seen domestic CN operations. Every counter-narcotic operation I've ever seen has been either military or civil air patrol run, which is a military Air Force auxiliary.
So you're saying that they don't have to have transponders?
No, every military aircraft is going to have IFF, but they don't necessarily have to have them on while they're doing the operation.
You know, I'll take this smuggler divided these up. You know, one is detecting, and then the other one is actually surveillance, real-time surveillance to find out who may be operating this thing. I think that goes back to the tradecraft with these guys is Mendoza and Magana. It seems that the incriminating evidence, that the only thing I can think of that was caught on the video, was the fact, the most basic thing, these guys were not wearing masks. That seems like the biggest thing here.
Well, the thing is that many people not only forgot to wear masks, but the other thing is, if there's a surveillance operation going on against, you know, someone, somewhere, some place, it's usually not just the place itself that is under surveillance, but the entry and exit routes as well. So you will have cameras on the streets leading to their place, and the cameras are pointing at the place. So if you're coming in or out with your car, your number plates will be recorded. So that is the other thing that is usually found in operations like that.
Great. I think that there's another thing that could be done is that if these cameras were set up with particular operations where they actually notified the police in real time, sort of like a tripwire type thing. So that would also touch back with the tradecraft of having monitored entry and exit points so that if there was to be some type of a raid that was happening real time with one of these tripwire things, that you would have a predefined blocking system or something like that, and an exit way, so that you knew exactly where that may be coming in. You know, sort of a reverse tripwire type thing. So there's a lot of great information in this. Real quick, before we move on to our last topic, we have plugs right now. Don't forget to check out Voodoo's website, blackandyellowpages.com. Voodoo, what can we do with Black and Yellow Pages?
You can find all sorts of agorist businesses there who have their wares listed. And if you want to list your agorist business, you can send me an email, voodoo@blackandyellowpages.com, and I will get you an invite to list for your free listings.
Super. And we have a special announcement for today. Shadowlife.cc is live. Smuggler, tell us about that.
Well, Shadow Life is mostly concerning itself with everything privacy, from people that claim to understand something about it towards people that don't understand anything about it yet. So we're trying to communicate concepts like how to encrypt your email, how to stay anonymous both online and offline, how to obscure the travel records, how to do basic live tradecraft, even if you're not an expert. And we're trying to help a few people with sharing our experience and actually to find out through our forum of all the other cool techs that are out there.
Okay, so you're going to have articles up, and then you have another community aspect of this with the forum.
Exactly.
Okay, super. Everyone check that out at shadowlife.cc. And Wise Guy has nothing to plug, but we do not forget to mention him. And you can check out my stuff over at agoristradio.com. Several shows there and more coming. And hey, Plato, you edited something recently besides episode 11. You want to tell us about that?
That's damn straight, hero. I actually edited Smuggler's Book, the Second Realm book on strategy. Did, you know, a few typo corrections, put it all in a markdown so it can be all sexified for 2012 World Wide Web. And if you're interested in finding some practical solutions and some great philosophy about crypto anarchy and bringing about individual liberty, check that out. It's at anarplex.net/hosted/files/secondrealm, one word.
Super. And on agoristradio.com, we have a cypherpunk show that where we actually, well, did a reading of the book also, if you'd rather listen to me do a vocal reading of it. All right, super guys. The last topic here. Plato, Kim.com, the ME.GA, Mega Domain Drama, and New Service Details. The Torrent Freak Post, Gabon government minister has said that his country will not be used as a base for committing copyright infringement, as it announced that his country will seize the new ME.GA domain. But while .com blames the United States and entertainment company Vivendi, a group of hackers say they have taken over the domain. Speaking with Torrent Freak, the group says that they are the two pirates and that .com is a megalomaniac. But this seems like something that Kim.com may have done himself. I mean, because .com knew full well in advance that this domain name was fully administered by the Vivendi Entertainment group. And then, it's being supposedly the government's not doing it, but then this other group has it. It just seems like this media drama. But I don't know. Tell me what your thoughts are on that. And also the new service details of his new service. There's some crypto stuff in there going on. Maybe you got something to tell us about that. And maybe you can mention something about his plan to sue the U.S. government for $400 million and lay some transocean fiber cable to give everyone in New Zealand free internet.
Jeez. All right. Well, so .com and Mega. He is a megalomaniac. I see him as like a Bond villain, more of like Robin Hood, but he does have balls of steel to just stick his dick in the beehive of the mafia and the U.S. government and Vivendi and all these other guys. So the situation here is that .com is planning on replacing the old Mega Upload, which is, you know, a file stash, with his new Mega product, and he registered the ME.GA domain, as you said, and the Gabon government shut it down. And I don't know if he did it himself, maybe not. It's very unclear, the current status of the domain, but it's certainly giving him some publicity for this new service. And it's slated to launch, I believe, January. And the idea here is that it's going to be like sort of like Dropbox, where you open up the Mega web page and you can see all your files and all your friends' files. And you can click upload and choose a file from your computer and it uploads it to a Mega server. Now the thing is that it encrypts it on the client side before you upload it, so the server operator has no liability and zero knowledge. And he's trying to get a whole shit ton of server operators to all join in a coalition, basically, because they have such low risk, because they're just storing encrypted data. And when you want to get your data back, you log back in, download it, decrypt it client-side, and voila. So my biggest concern here is you got to trust Mega's client-side software. And if they decide to go rogue and put in some code to like sniff your passwords like Hushmail did, we don't have any defense against that right now. And I know we've covered this idea of frozen JavaScript in previous episodes. And again, that's a way of having your web browser detect whether a JavaScript file has been modified since you last checked it over. And if.com releases the software and puts out its source code to the public and gets it vetted and audited and people are sure that it is legit client-side crypto and he's not trying to scam you and take all your stuff, then it's safe to use. But only as long as you're sure that the JavaScript you just downloaded today is the same as the one that's been vetted already.
Okay, I see that as a threat model dealing with people who would be using this service for private information and wondering, you know, you thinking, oh, everything's encrypted, so I'm going to upload my private documents and share them with other people. But I don't think that Kim.com gives a shit about anybody's privacy. What he's interested in is how can he run this service and how can it be kept from shutting down himself. So, and most people using this, if they were going to be using it for exchanging movies and music and things like that, they also don't necessarily care so much about the privacy of their file as much as the server operators themselves being able to claim deniability for what's happening and then avoid some type of shutdown.
Yeah, the way they're setting it up is to protect the servers, definitely. And a nice side effect of that is that if it works as intended, it will protect the users as well. Let's see, what were the other things you mentioned? The cable. He's planning on reviving a transatlantic cable that ran out of money that was trying to connect, I think, LA and New Zealand. So his goal is to build this thing and hook New Zealand up into the nice, fast American internet, give New Zealanders internet access for free, and make a bunch of money paying for the traffic or charging for the traffic.
Is that a realistic price for that much undersea cable?
I'm not sure what he paid, but it's got to be pretty cool. Hey, babe, you want to come back to my yacht and see the cable?
Well, you know, Plato, you just mentioned, though, something I didn't see before, was that this is not talking about laying a new cable. This isn't talking about him laying new pipe. This is an existing project that failed that already has infrastructure for the cable?
That's correct.
Okay, so then the $400 million could be something that would do that.
You know, guys, there's already a service out there that is providing something like this, which is btcserv.tk. And what they do is they provide a place that you can upload your files, which get encrypted by the server, but then they don't hold the encryption keys. They send them to the uploader, and without that decryption key, of course, you can't download the file or get any of the information. So that way they have plausible deniability of their content.
One thing that I just got to bring up again, and sorry if security and cybertech bores you, but SSL is no longer secure and certificates can be spoofed. And I'm pretty sure that means that a middleman, say at the ISP level, can intercept the traffic that's coming from btserv.tk or from Mega and replace the keys and modify the JavaScript there and deliver it to you. As smuggler, am I accurate in that? Could a third-party attacker taint the code?
Yeah, sure. If you go into the SSL, you can, and there are probably enough rogue certificate authorities out there and rogue certificates out there that you can do that, yes. There are actually boxes for that are on sale.
Yeah, but the thing is that's just an attack against the individual.
And right. I'm thinking more on the scale of a state attacker trying to hit individual Mega users. Say they're looking at them because they smuggled in some silver or something across the border, and they want to get as much information as possible and find all of any private files they have stored on Mega.
Yeah, of course. Go ahead, Smuggler.
Yeah, if it comes to an attack on an individual user, it's most likely that they're not actually using SSL boxes. Often it's much cheaper to break into the computer of the individual and go from there. And that's often pretty trivial to listen to a single browser locally. Otherwise, sure, you can go to the ISP level and do SSL. But the thing is, if you can go close to the startup server for whatever system Mega does, so essentially the bootstrapping server, if you can take over the connections to that server centrally, maybe, by going to the data center where it's hosted, you can probably break the security of all the other servers as well, which is an issue that has been exploited a lot against banking websites, where essentially SSL is reduced by changing code in just a single page and then keeping that page from going to good SSL in the future.
Well, if an attacker managed to compromise the one of the main servers from Mega, they might well be able to get the any subsidiary servers. But as I understand it, assuming the client-side crypto is working properly, that attacker would not be able to get anyone's files or read anyone's files, although they could, again, do that JavaScript attack and deliver malicious code in order to get the keys.
I think that that should be taken for granted, that that's gonna happen, and that it's gonna be trivial for anyone to do, and that the people using the service should also, this is part of the whole thing with him being some megalomaniac, is that when he keeps talking about this crypto and everything like that, his only concern is that his business does not get shut down. Now, I'm not saying that that's, he's some evil capitalist because of that, but the idea here is not about individual privacy. Okay, what this is about is him playing a game of jurisdictional arbitrage. He's placing servers in all kinds of jurisdictions, and then for people to go after these things and to find out what's happening, they're going to maybe some of the servers are going to be shut down by certain countries and the like that. But his service is going to, his plan is to make sure that his service continues to operate. So your individual privacy, he has no concern over. It just has to do with the certain levels of encryption that are being done and how it's being handled, giving the operators of the servers themselves some type of deniability, and then they have legal protection to continue operating, as opposed to them being able to go see the server and then prove what's happening on it and all this, and that he was actually involved with the copyright infringement himself. So this is about him protecting his ass. And all your points about the security of you using as an individual, yeah, man, nobody should be using this service for anything that they are concerned about their privacy with.
I mean, the real thing here is we don't know how exactly his service will be structured. We know nothing about the protocols. So that remains to be seen if that service ever goes online. The interesting part is that there are actually services like that already existing. For example, Tahoe Labs, which is a distributed file system that uses encryption, which is the smart way. If you want to distribute files, get a Tahoe node, put it on the net, interconnect, and then work from there.
Hiro, let me add one more thing with this Mega Upload stuff. And that's that the US/Mafia case against .com and Mega Upload is still going on. And a whole bunch of people had their legitimate files stored on Mega Upload using it as a cloud backup service. And the EFF and this guy named Goodwin, they're suing the government because Goodwin has no way of getting his videos, legitimate, home videos, off the servers. And the government in the court told the judge, well, here's what Mr. Goodman should do if he wants his files back. First off, the court needs to be assured that he's not some counterfeiter or some scammer. And second, you need to see how much it's going to cost to get his data on all those terabytes of servers, and how to make sure that he's not taking back his copyrighted intellectual property infringing content, and whether other cheaper remedies exist, such as data recovery from Mr. Goodwin's hard drive. Data recovery from a hard drive, that's like hundreds of bucks already. So the rest of this stuff, the court's going to charge him fees for looking through all the files and seeing and finding them, which is going to take hours, of course. So it's just impressive to see how much everybody's getting fucked with this.
Yeah, that's completely insane. Well, you know, what's the lesson here? First lesson is, you know, if you think that you're sticking your stuff in the cloud and that you're going to have any recourse if anything happens in any way at all, you can pretty much forget about it. This wraps up episode 13 of Reality Exploit Roundtable. Thank you for listening. This has been another great show. Thank you, everybody, for participating and all your great feedback and comments. And everybody, check out on agoristradio.com other show episodes of Reality Exploit Roundtable, and we will see you again next week.